unless your own skin is fouler still, and fresher."
He unsheathed his dagger, an ugly piece of cheap iron.
"A woman freakish big and freakish strong who hides her own true colours. Cray, behold the Maid of Tarth, who opened Renly's royal throat for him."
"That is a lie."
Renly Baratheon had been more than a king to her. She had loved him since first he came to Tarth, on his leisurely lord's progress, to mark his coming of age. Her father welcomed him with a feast and commanded her to attend. Elsewise, she would have hidden in her room like some wounded beast. She had been no older than Sansa, more afraid of sniggers than of swords.
"They will know about the rose," she told Lord Selwyn. "They will laugh at me."
But the Even Star would not relent, and Renly Baratheon had shown her every courtesy, as if she were a proper maid and pretty. He even danced with her. And in his arms she felt graceful, and her feet had floated across the floor. Later, others begged a dance of her, because of his example. From that day forth, she wanted only to be close to Lord Renly, to serve him and protect him. But in the end, she failed him.
"Renly died in my arms, but I did not kill him," she thought.
But these hedge knights would never understand.
"I would have given my life for King Renly, and died happy," she said. "I did no harm to him. I swear it by my sword."
"A knight swears by his sword,"
Sir Creighton said.
"Swear it by the Seven,"
urged Sir Illifer the Penniless.
"By the Seven, then. I did no harm to King Renly. I swear it by the Mother. May I never know her mercy if I lie. I swear it by the Father, and ask that he might judge me justly. I swear it by the Maiden and Crone, by the Smith and the Warrior, and I swear it by the Stranger. May he take me now, if I am false."
"Oh, she swears well for a maid,"
Sir Crichton allowed.
"Aye,"
Sir Illifer the Penniless gave a shrug.
"Well, if she lied, the gods will sort her out."
He slipped his dagger back away.
"The first watch is yours."
As the hedge knight slept, Brian paced restlessly around the little camp, listening to the crackle of the fire.
"I should ride on whilst I can."
She did not know these men, yet she could not bring herself to leave them undefended. Even in the black of night, there were riders on the road, and noise in the woods that might or might not have been owls and prowling foxes. So Brian paced, and kept her blade loose in its scabbard. Her watch was easy, all in all. It was after that was hard. When Sir Elifer woke and said he would relieve her, Brian spread a blanket on the ground and curled up to close her eyes.
"I will not sleep," she told herself, bone-weary though she was.
She had never slept easily in the presence of men, even in Lord Renly's camps. The risk of rape was always there. It was a lesson she had learned beneath the walls of Highgarden, and again when she and Jamie had fallen into the hands of the brave companions. The cold in the earth had seeped through Brian's blankets to soak into her bones. Before long, every muscle felt clenched and cramped, from her jaw down to her toes. She wondered whether Sansa Stark was cold as well, wherever she might be. Lady Catelyn had said that Sansa was a gentle soul who loved lemon cakes, silken gowns, and songs of chivalry. Yet the girl had seen her father's head lopped off, and been forced to marry one of his killers afterwards. If half the tales were true, the dwarf was the cruelest Lannister of all.
"If she did poison King Joffrey, the imp surely forced her hand. She was alone and friendless at that court."
In King's Landing, Brienne had hunted down a certain Brella, who had been one of Sansa's maids. The woman told her that there was little warmth between Sansa and the dwarf. Perhaps she'd been fleeing him as well as Joffrey's murder. Whatever dreams Brienne dreamed were gone when dawn awoke her. Her legs were stiff as wood from the cold ground, but no one had molested her, and her goods remained untouched. The hedge knights were up and about. Sir Elifer was cutting up a squirrel for breakfast, while Sir Creighton stood facing a tree, having himself a good long piss.
"Edge knights," she thought, "old and vain and plump and near-sighted, yet decent men, for all that."
It cheered her to know there were still decent men in the world. They broke their fast on roast squirrel, acorn paste, and pickles, while Sir Creighton regaled her with his exploits on the Blackwater, where he had slain a dozen fearsome knights that she had never heard of.
"Oh, it was a rare fight, milady," he said, "a rare and bloody fray."
He allowed that Sir Ilifer had fought nobly in the battle as well. Ilifer himself said little. When time came to resume their journey, the knights fell in on either side of her, like guards protecting some great lady, though this lady dwarfed both of her protectors and was better armed and armoured in the nonce.
"Did anyone pass by during your watches?"
Brian asked them.
"Such as a maid of 3 and 10, with auburn hair,"
said Sir Ilifer the penniless.
"No, my lady, no one." "I had a few," Sir Creighton put in. "Some farm-boy and a piebald horse went by, and a hour later half a dozen men afoot with staves and scythes. They caught sight of our fire and stopped for a long look at our horses, but I showed them a glimpse of my steel and told them to be along their way. Rough fellows by the look of them, and desperate too, but ne'er so desperate as to trifle with Sir Creighton Longbow."
No, Brian thought, not so desperate as that. She turned away to hide her smile. Thankfully, Sir Creighton was too intent on the tale of his epic battle with the Knight of the Red Chicken to make note of the maiden's mirth. It felt good to have companions on the road, even such companions as these two. It was midday when Brian heard chanting drifting through the bare brown trees.
"What is that sound?"
Sir Creighton asked.
"Voices raised in prayer."
Brian knew the chant.
"They are beseeching the warrior for protection, asking the crone to light their way."
Sir Ilifer the penniless bared his battered blade and reined in his horse to wait their coming.
"They are close now."
The chanting filled the woods like pious thunder, and suddenly the source of the sound appeared in the road ahead. A group of begging brothers led the way. Scruffy bearded men in rough-spun robes, some barefoot and some in sandals. Behind them marched 70 ragged men, women and children, a spotted sow and several sheep. Several of the men had axes and more had crude wooden clubs and cudgels. In their midst there rolled a 2-wheeled wain of grey and splintered wood, piled high with skulls and broken bits of bone. When they saw the hedge knights, the begging brothers halted, and their chanting died away.
"Good night," one said. "The mother loves you."
"And you, brother," said Sir Ilifer. "Who are you?"
"Poor fellows," said a big man with an axe. Despite the chill of the autumnal wood, he was shirtless, and on his breast was carved a 7-pointed star. Andal warriors had carved such stars in their flesh when first they crossed the narrow sea to overwhelm the kingdoms of the first men.
"We are marching to the city,"
said a tall woman in the traces of the wind,
"to bring these holy bones to blessed Bela and seek succour and protection from the king." "Join us, friends,"
urged a spare small man in a threadbare septon's robe, who wore a crystal on a thong about his neck.
"Westeros has need of every sword."
"We were bound for Duskendale," declared Sir Creighton, "but mayhaps we can see you safely to King's Landing."
"If you have the coin to pay us for this escort," added Sir Ilifer,
who seemed practical as well as penniless.
"Sparrows need no gold,"
the septon said. Sir Creighton was lost.
"Sparrows?" "The sparrow is the humblest and most common of birds, as we are the humblest and most common of men."
The septon had a lean, sharp face and a short beard, grizzled grey and brown. His thin hair was pulled back and knotted behind his head, and his feet were bare and black, gnarled and hard as tree roots.
"These are the bones of holy men, murdered for their faith. They served the Seven even unto death. Some starved, some were tortured. Septs have been despoiled, maidens and mothers raped by godless men and demon worshippers. Even silent sisters have been molested. Our Mother above cries out in her anguish. It is time for all anointed knights to forsake their worldly masters and defend our holy faith. Come with us to the city, if you love the Seven."
"I love them well enough," said Illifer. "Yet I must eat.
So must all the Mother's children."
"We are bound for Duskendale,"
Sir Illifer said flatly. One of the begging knights spat, and a woman gave a moan.
"You are false knights,"
said the big man with a star carved on his chest. Several others brandished their cudgels. The barefoot septon calmed them with a word.
"Judge not, for judgment is the Father's. Let them pass in peace. They are poor fellows too, lost upon the earth."
Brian edged her mare forward.
"My sister is lost as well, a girl of 3 and 10, with auburn hair, fair to look upon."
"All the mother's children are fair to look upon. May the maiden watch over this poor girl, and you as well, I think."
The septon lifted one of the traces of the wain upon his shoulder and began to pull. The begging brothers took up the chant once more. Brian and the hedge knights sat upon their horses as the procession moved slowly past, following the rutted road toward Rosby. The sound of their chanting slowly dwindled away and died. Sir Creighton lifted one cheek off the saddle to scratch his arse.
"What sort of man would slay a holy septon?"
Brian knew what sort. Near Maidenpool, she recalled, the brave companions had strung a septon up by the heels from the limb of a tree, and used his corpse for archery practice. She wondered if his bones were piled in that wain with all the rest.
"A man would need to be a fool to rape a silent sister,"
Sir Creighton was saying.
"Even to lay hands upon one. It's said that they are the stranger's wives, and their female parts are cold and wet as ice."
He glanced at Brian.
Beg pardon.
Brian spurned her mare towards Duskendale. After a moment, Sir Illifer followed, and Sir Creighton came, bringing up the rear. 3 hours later, they came upon another party, struggling toward Duskendale, a merchant and his serving men accompanied by yet another hedge knight. The merchant rode a dapple grey mare, whilst his servants took turns pulling his wagon. 4 laboured in the traces as the other 2 walked beside the wheels. But when they heard the sound of horses, they formed up around the wagon with quarter-staffs of ash at the ready. The merchant produced a crossbow, the knight a blade.
"You will forgive me if I am suspicious," called the merchant, "but the times are troubled, and I have only good Sir Shadrick to defend me. Who are you?"
"I," Sir Creighton said, affronted, "I am the famous Sir Creighton Longbow, fresh from battle on the Blackwater, and this is my companion, Sir Illifer the Penniless."
"We mean you no harm," said Brian.
The merchant considered her doubtfully.
"My lady, you should be safe at home. Why do you wear such unnatural garb?"
"I am searching for my sister."
She dared not mention Sansa's name, with her accused of regicide.
"She's a high-born maid and beautiful, with blue eyes and auburn hair. Perhaps you saw her with a portly knight of 40 years, or a drunken fool."
"The roads are full of drunken fools and despoiled maidens.
As for portly knights, it is hard for any honest man to keep his belly round when so many lack food."
"Though your Sir Creighton has not hungered, it will seem."
"I have big bones," Sir Creighton insisted. "Shall we ride together for a time? I do not doubt Sir Shadrick's valour, but he seems small, and 3 blades are better than 1.
4 blades,
thought Brian,
but she held her tongue. The merchant looked to his escort. "What say you, sir?"
"Oh, these three are naught to fear."
Sheshedrick was a wiry, fox-faced man with a sharp nose and a shock of orange hair mounted on a rangy chestnut courser. Though he could not have been more than 5'2", he had a cocksure manner.
"This one is old, t'other fat, and the big one is a woman. Let them come."
"As you say," the merchant lowered his crossbow. As they resumed their journey, the hard knight dropped back and looked her up and down as if she were a side of good salt pork.
"You're a strapping, healthy wench, I'd say."
Sir James's mockery had cut her deep. The little man's words hardly touched her.
"A giant compared to some,"
he laughed.
"I am big enough where it counts, wench."
"The merchant called you Shadrick."
"Sir Shadrick of the Shady Glen. Some call me the Mad Mouse."
He turned his shield to show her his sigil, a large white mouse with fierce red eyes on bendy brown and blue.
"The brown is for the lands I've roamed, the blue for the rivers that I've crossed. The mouse is me."
"And are you mad?"
"Oh, quite. Your common mouse will run from blood and battle. The mad mouse seeks them out. It will seem he seldom finds them." "Oh, I find enough. 'Tis true I am no tourney knight. I save my valour for the battlefield woman."
Woman was marginally better than wench, she supposed.
"You and good Sir Creighton have much in common, then."
Sir Shadrick laughed.
"Oh, I doubt that. But it may be that you and I share a quest. A little lost sister, is it? With blue eyes and auburn hair."
He laughed again.
"You're not the only hunter in the woods. I seek for Sansa Stark as well."
Brian kept her face a mask to hide her dismay.
"Who is this Sansa Stark? And why did you seek her?"
"For love. Why else?"
She furrowed her brow.
"Love? Aye, love of gold. Unlike your good Sir Creighton, I did fight upon the Blackwater, but on the losing side. My ransom ruined me. You know who Varys is, I trust? The eunuch has offered a plump bag of gold for this girl you've never heard of. I'm not a greedy man. If some oversized wench would help me find this naughty child, I would split the spider's coin with her."
"I thought you were in this merchant's hire."
"Only as far as Duskendale. Hybold is as niggardly as he is fearful, and he is very fearful. What do you say, wench?"
"I know no Sansa Stark," she insisted. "I am searching for my sister, a high-born girl, with blue eyes and auburn hair, aye. Pray, who is this knight who travels with your sister? Or did you name him fool?"
Sir Shadrick did not wait for her answer, which was good, since she had none.
"A certain fool vanished from King's Landing the night King Joffrey died, a stout fellow with a nose full of broken veins, one Sir Dontus the Red, formerly of Duskendale. I pray your sister and her drunken fool are not mistaken for this Stark girl and Sir Dontus. That could be most unfortunate."
He put his heels into his courser and trotted on ahead. Even Jaime Lannister had seldom made Brian feel such a fool.
"You are not the only hunter in the woods."
The woman, Brella, had told her how Joffrey had stripped Sir Dontus of his spurs, how Lady Sansa begged Joffrey for his life.
"He helped her flee,"
Brian had decided when she heard the tale.
"Find Sir Dontus, and I will find Sansa."
She should have known there would be others who would see it too.
"Some may even be less savoury than Sir Shadrick."
She could only hope that Sir Dontus had hidden Sansa well.
"But if so, how will I ever find her?"
She hunched her shoulders down and rode on, frowning. Night was gathering by the time their party came upon the inn, a tall, timbered building
that stood beside a river junction, astride an old stone bridge. That was the inn's name, Sir Creighton told them, the old stone bridge. The innkeep was a friend of his.
And not a bad cook, and the rooms have no more fleas than most, he vouched. Who's for a warm bed tonight? Not us, or unless your friend has given them away, said Sir Illifer the penniless. We have no coin for rooms.
I can pay for the three of us. Brian did not lack for coin. Jamie had seen to that. In her saddlebag she found a purse fat with silver stags and copper stars, a smaller one stuffed with golden dragons, and a parchment commanding all loyal subjects of the king to assist the bearer. Brian of House Tarth, who was about his grace's business. It was signed in a childish hand by Tommen, the first of his name, King of the Andals, the Rhoynar, and the First Men, and Lord of the Seven Kingdoms. Hybald was for stopping, too, and bid his men to leave the wagon near the stables. Warm yellow light shone through the diamond-shaped panes of the inn's windows, and Brian heard a stallion trumpet at the scent of her mare. She was loosening the shadow when a boy came out the stable door and said,
"Let me do that, sir." "I am no sir," she told him, "but you may take the horse, see that she has fed and brushed and watered."
The boy reddened.
"I beg pardon, my lady, I thought—"
"It's a common mistake."
Brian gave him the reins and followed the others into the inn, with her saddlebags across her shoulder and her bedroll tucked up beneath one arm. Sawdust covered the plank floor of the common room, and the air smelled of hops and smoke and meat. A roast was spitting and crackling over the fire, unattended for the moment. Six locals sat about a table talking, but they broke off when the strangers entered. Brian could feel their eyes. Despite chainmail, cloak, and jerkin, she felt naked. When one man said,
"Have a look at that,"
she knew he was not speaking of Sir Shadrick. The innkeeper appeared, clutching three tankards in each hand and slopping ale at every step.
"Do you have rooms, good man?"
the merchant asked him.
"I might,"
the innkeeper said.
"For them as has coin."
Sir Creighton Longbow looked offended.
"Nuggle, is that how you would greet an old friend? 'Tis me, Longbow. Oh, 'tis you indeed. You owe me seven stags. Show me some silver, and I'll show you a bed."
The innkeep set the tankards down one by one, slopping more ale on the table in the process.
"I will pay for one room for myself, and a second for my two companions,"
Brian indicated, Sir Creighton and Sir Illifer.
"I shall take a room as well," said the merchant, "for myself and good Sir Shadrick. My serving men will bed down in your stables, if it please you."
The innkeep looked them over.
"It don't please me, but might be I'll allow it. Will you be wanting supper? That's good goat on the spit, that is."
"I shall judge its goodness for myself," Hybald announced. "My men will content themselves with bread and drippings."
And so they supped. Brian tried the goat herself, after following the innkeep up the steps, pressing some coins into his hand and stashing her goods in the second room he showed her. She ordered goat for Sir Creighton and Sir Illifer as well, since they had shared their trout with her. The hedge knights and the septon washed down the meat with ale, but Brian drank a cup of goat's milk. She listened to the table talk, hoping against hope that she might hear something that would help her find Sansa.
"You come from King's Landing," one of the locals said to Hybald. "Is it true that the King's Slayer's been crippled?"
"True enough," Hybald said. "He's lost his sword hand."
"Aye," Sir Creighton said. "Chewed off by a dire wolf, I hear. One of them monsters come down from the north. Nought that's good ever come from the north. Even their gods are queer."
"It was not a wolf,"
Brian heard herself say.
"Sir Jamie lost his hand to a Kohorric sellsword."
"It's no easy thing to fight with your offhand," observed the Mad Mouse.
"Bah," said Sir Creighton Longbow.
As it happens, I fight as well with either hand.
Oh, I have no doubt of that. Sir Shadrick lifted his tankard in salute.
Brian remembered her fight with Jaime Lannister in the woods. It had been all she could do to keep his blade at bay.
He was weak from his imprisonment and chained at the wrists. No knight in the Seven Kingdoms could have stood against him at his full strength, with no chains to hamper him.
Jaime had done many wicked things, but the man could fight. His maiming had been monstrously cruel. It was one thing to slay a lion, another to hack his paw off and leave him broken and bewildered. Suddenly the common room was too loud to endure a moment longer. She muttered her good nights and took herself up to bed. The ceiling in her room was low. Entering with a taper in her hand, Brian had to duck or crack her head. The only furnishings were a bed wide enough to sleep six, and the stub of a tallow candle on the sill. She lit it with a taper, barred the door, and hung her sword belt from a bedpost. Her scabbard was a plain thing, wood wrapped in cracked brown leather, and her sword was plainer still. She had bought it in King's Landing to replace the blade the brave companions had stolen.
Renly's sword.
It still hurt, knowing she had lost it. But she had another long sword hidden in her bedroll. She sat on the bed and took it out. Gold glimmered yellow in the candlelight, and rubies smouldered red. When she slid Oathkeeper from the ornate scabbard, Brian's breath caught in her throat. Black and red the ripples ran, deep within the steel.
Valyrian steel, spell forged.
It was a sword fit for a hero. When she was small, her nurse had filled her ears with tales of valour, regaling her with the noble exploits of Sir Galadon of Morn, Florian the Fool, Prince Aemon the Dragon Knight, and other champions. Each man bore a famous sword, and surely Oathkeeper belonged in their company, even if she herself did not. "You'll be defending Ned Stark's daughter, with Ned Stark's own steel," Jaime had promised. Kneeling between the bed and wall, she held the blade and said a silent prayer to the crone, whose golden lamp showed men the way through life.
"Lead me,"
she prayed.
"Light the way before me. Show me the path that leads to Sansa."
She had failed Renly, had failed Lady Caitlin. She must not fail Jaime.
"He trusted me with his sword. He trusted me with his honor."
Afterwards she stretched out on the bed as best she could. For all its width, it was not long enough. So Brian lay across it sideways. She could hear the clatter of tankards from below and voices drifting up the steps. The fleas that Longbow had spoken of put in their appearance. Scratching helped keep her awake. She heard Hybald mount the stairs, and sometime later the knights as well.
"I never knew his name," Sir Clayton was saying as he went by, "but upon his shield he wore a blood-red chicken, and his blade was dripping gore."
His voice faded, and somewhere up above a door opened and closed. Her candle burned out. Darkness settled over the old stone bridge, and the inn grew so still that she could hear the murmur of the river. Only then did Brian rise to gather up her things. She eased the door open, listened, made her way barefoot down the steps. Outside she donned her boots and hurried to the stable to saddle her bay mare, asking a silent pardon of Sir Creighton and Sir Illifer as she mounted. One of Hybald's serving men woke when she rode past him, but made no move to stop her. Her mare's hooves rang upon the old stone bridge. Then the trees closed in around her, black as pitch, and full of ghosts and memories.
"I am coming for you, Lady Sansa," she thought, as she rode into the darkness. "Be not afraid. I shall not rest until I have found you."
Samwell. Sam was reading about the others when he saw the mouse. His eyes were red and raw,
I ought not to rub them so much, he always told himself as he rubbed them. The dust made them itch and water, and the dust was everywhere down here. Little puffs of it filled the air every time a page was turned, and it rose in grey clouds whenever he shifted a stack of books to see what might be hiding on the bottom. Sam did not know how long it had been since last he slept, but scarce an inch remained of the fat tallow candle he'd lit when starting on the ragged bundle of loose pages that he'd found tied up in twine. He was beastly tired, but it was hard to stop. "One more book," he had told himself, "then I'll stop. One more folio, just one more page, then I'll go up and rest and get a bite to eat." But there was always another page after that one, and another after that, and another book waiting underneath the pile. "I'll just take a quick peek to see what this one is about," he'd think. And before he knew, he would be halfway through it. He had not eaten since that bowl of bean and bacon soup with Pip and Grin. "Well, except for the bread and cheese, but that was only a nibble," he thought. That was when he took a quick glance at the empty platter and spied the mouse, feasting on the breadcrumbs. The mouse was half as long as his pinky finger, with black eyes and soft grey fur. Sam knew he ought to kill it. Mice might prefer bread and cheese, but they ate paper too. He found plenty of mouse droppings amongst the shelves and stacks, and some of the leather covers of the books showed signs of being gnawed.
"It's such a little thing, though, and hungry. How could he begrudge it a few crumbs? It's eating books, though."
After hours in the chair, Sam's back was stiff as a board, and his legs were half asleep. He knew he was not quick enough to catch the mouse, but it might be he could squash it. By his elbow rested a massive leather-bound copy of Annals of the Black Centaur, Septon Jorquin's exhaustively detailed account of the 9 years that Orbert Caswell had served as Lord Commander of the Night's Watch. There was a page for each day of his term, every one of which seemed to begin, "Lord Osbert rose at dawn and moved his bowels," except for the last, which said, "Lord Orbert was found to have died during the night."
"No mouse is a match for Septon Jorquin."
Very slowly, Sam took hold of the book with his left hand. It was thick and heavy, and when he tried to lift it one-handed, it slipped from his plump fingers and thumped back down. The mouse was gone in half a heartbeat. Skittery quick. Sam was relieved. Squishing the poor little thing would have given him nightmares.
"You shouldn't eat the books, though," he said aloud.
Maybe he should bring more cheese the next time he came down here. He was surprised at how low the candle had burned. Had the bean and bacon soup been today or yesterday?
Yesterday. It must have been yesterday.
The realization made him yawn. John would be wondering what had become of him, though Maester Aemon would no doubt understand. Before he had lost his sight, the Maester had loved books as much as Samuel Tarley did. He understood the way that you could sometimes fall right into them, as if each page was a hole into another world. Pushing himself to his feet, Sam grimaced at the pins and needles in his calves. The chair was very hard and cut into the back of his thighs when he bent over a book.
"I need to remember to bring a cushion."
It would be even better if he could sleep down here, in the cell he'd found half hidden behind four chests, full of loose pages that had gotten separated from the books they belonged to. But he did not want to leave Maester Aemon alone for so long. He had not been strong of late, and required help, especially with the ravens. Aemon had Clydus, to be sure, but Sam was younger and better with the birds. With a stack of books and scrolls under his left arm, and the candle in his right hand, Sam made his way down the tunnels the brothers called the Wormways. A pale shaft of light illuminated the steep stone steps that led up to the surface, so he knew that day had come up top. He left the candle burning in a wall niche and began to climb. By the fifth step he was puffing. At the tenth he stopped to shift the books to his right arm. He emerged beneath the sky, the colour of white lead. A snow sky, Sam thought, squinting up. The prospect made him uneasy. He remembered that night on the Fist of the First Men, when the whites and the snows had come together.
"Don't be so craven," he thought. "You have your sworn brothers all around you, not to mention Stannis Baratheon and all his knights."
Castle Black's keeps and towers rose about him, dwarfed by the icy immensity of the wall. A small army was crawling over the ice a quarter of the way up, where a new switchback stair was creeping upward to meet the remnants of the old one. The sounds of their saws and hammers echoed off the ice. John had the builders working night and day on the task. Sam had heard some of the complaining about it over supper, insisting that Lord Mormont never worked them half so hard. Without the great stair there was no way to reach the top of the wall, except by the chain winch, however. And as much as Samuel Tarly hated steps, he hated the winch cage more. He always closed his eyes when he was riding it, convinced that the chain was about to break. Every time the iron cage scraped against the ice, his heart stopped beating for an instant.
"There were dragons here 200 years ago, Sam found himself thinking as he watched the cage making a slow descent. "They would just have flown to the top of the wall."
Queen Alysanne had visited Castle Black on her dragon, and Jaehaerys, her king, had come after her on his own. Could Silverwing had left an egg behind, or had Stannis found one egg on Dragonstone?
"Even if he has an egg, how can he hope to quicken it?"
Baelor the Blessed had prayed over his eggs, and other Targaryens had sought to hatch theirs with sorcery. All they got for it was farce and tragedy.
"Samwell," said a glum voice, "I was coming in to fetch you. I was told to bring you to the Lord Commander."
A snowflake landed on Sam's nose.
"John wants to see me."
"As to that, I could not say," said Dolorous Ed Tollett. "I never wanted to see half the things I've seen, and I've never seen half the things I wanted to. I don't think wanting comes into it. You'd best go all the same. Lord Snow wishes to speak with you as soon as he is done with Craister's wife."
"Jilly?"
"That's the one. If my wet nurse had looked like her, I'd still be on the teat. Mine had whiskers."
"Most goats do,"
called Pip, as he and Gren emerged from around the corner with longbows in hand and quivers of arrows on their backs.
"Where have you been, Slayer? We missed you last night at supper. A whole roast ox went uneaten."
"Don't call me Slayer."
Sam ignored the jibe about the ox. That was just Pip.
"I was reading. There was a mouse."
"Don't mention mice to Gren. He's terrified of mice."
"I am not,"
Gren declared with indignation.
"You'd be too scared to eat one." "I'd eat more mice than you would."
Dolorous Ed Tollett gave a sigh.
"When I was a lad, we only ate mice on special feast days. I was the youngest, so I always got the tail. There's no meat on the tail."
"Where's your longbow, Sam?" asked Gren.
Sir Alistair used to call him Oryx, and every day he seemed to grow into the name a little more. He had come to the wall big but slow, thick of neck, thick of waist, red of face, and clumsy, though his neck still reddened when Pip twisted him around into some folly. Hours of work with sword and shield had flattened his belly, hardened his arms, broadened his chest. He was strong, and shaggy as an oryx, too.
"Ulmer was expecting you at the butts."
"Ulmer?" Sam said, abashed. Almost the first thing John Snow had done as Lord Commander was institute daily archery drill for the entire garrison, even stewards and cooks. The watch had been placing too much emphasis on the sword, and too little on the bow, he had said, a relic of the days when one brother in every 10 had been a knight, instead of one in every 100. Sam saw the sense in the decree, but he hated longbow practice almost as much as he hated climbing steps. When he wore his gloves, he could never hit anything, but when he took them off, he got blisters on his fingers. Those bows were dangerous. Saturn had torn off half his thumbnail on a bowstring.
I forgot. You broke the art of the wildling princess slayer, said Pip.
Of late, Val had taken to watching them from the window of her chamber in the king's tower.
She was looking for you.
She was not. I don't say that.
Sam had only spoken to Val twice, when Maester Aemon called upon her to make sure the babes were healthy. The princess was so pretty that he oft found himself stammering and blushing in her presence.
"Why not?" asked Pip. "She wants to have your children. Maybe we should call you Sam the Seducer."
Sam reddened. King Stannis had plans for Val, he knew. She was the mortar with which he meant to seal the peace between the Northmen and the Free Folk.
"I don't have time for archery today. I need to go see John."
"John?
John? Do we know anyone named John, Gwen?"
"He means the Lord Commander."
"Oh, the great Lord Snow, to be sure. Why do you want to see him? He can't even wiggle his ears."
Pip wiggled his to show he could. They were large ears and red from cold.
"He's Lord Snow for true now. Too bloody high-born for the likes of us."
"John has duties," Sam said in his defence. "The wall is his, and all that goes with it.
A man has duties to his friends as well. If not for us, Janus Slint might be our Lord Commander. Lord Janus would have sent Snow ranging naked on a mule. 'Scamper on up to Craister's Keep,' he would have said, 'and fetch me back the old bear's cloak and boots.' We saved him from that. But now he has too many duties to drink a cup of mulled wine by the fire."
Gren agreed. "His duties don't keep him from the yard. More days than not, he's out there fighting someone." That was true, Sam had to admit. Once when John came to consult with Maester Aemon, Sam had asked him why he spent so much time at swordplay.
"The old bear never trained much when he was Lord Commander," he had pointed out.
In answer, John had pressed Longclaw into Sam's hand. He let him feel the lightness, the balance, had him turn the blade so the ripples gleamed in the smoke-dark metal. "Valerian steel," he said. "Spell-forged and razor-sharp, nigh on indestructible. A swordsman should be as good as his sword, Sam. Longclaw is Valerian steel, but I'm not. The half-hand could have killed me as easy as you swat a bug." Sam handed back the sword.
"When I try to swat a bug, it always flies away. All I do is slap my arm. It stings."
That made John laugh. "As you will. Corrin could have killed me as easy as you eat a bowl of porridge." Sam was fond of porridge, especially when it was sweetened with honey.
"I don't have time for this."
Sam left his friends and made his way toward the armory, clutching his books to his chest.
"I am the shield that guards the realms of men," he remembered.
He wondered what those men would say if they realized their realms were being guarded by the likes of Gren, Pip, and Dolorous Edd. The Lord Commander's tower had been gutted by fire, and Stannis Baratheon had claimed the King's Tower for his own residence, so Jon Snow had established himself in Dunnel Noy's mother's quarters behind the armory. Gilly was leaving as Sam arrived, wrapped up in the old cloak he'd given her when they were fleeing Craister's Keep. She almost rushed right past him, but Sam caught her arm spinning two books as he did.
Jelly! Sam!
Her voice sounded raw. Jelly was dark-haired and slim, with the big brown eyes of a doe. She was swallowed by the folds of Sam's old cloak, her face half hidden by its hood, but shivering all the same. Her face looked wan and frightened.
"What's wrong?" Sam asked her. "How are the babes?"
Jilly pulled loose from him.
"They're good, Sam. Good. Between the two of them, it's a wonder you can sleep," Sam said pleasantly. "Which one was it that I heard crying last night? I thought he'd never stop. A Dallas boy. He cries when he wants a teat. Mine hardly ever cries. Sometimes he gurgles, but..."
Her eyes filled with tears.
"I have to go. It's past time that I've fed them. I'll be leaking all over myself if I don't go."
She rushed across the yard, leaving Sam perplexed behind her. He had to get down on his knees to gather up the books he'd dropped.
"I should not have brought so many," he told himself as he brushed the dirt of Colloquo Voltaire's Jade Compendium,
a thick volume of tales and legends from the East that Maester Aemon had commanded him to find. The book appeared on damage, Maester Tomax's Dragonkin being a history of House Targaryen from exile to apotheosis, with a consideration of the life and death of dragons, had not been so fortunate. It had come open as it fell, and a few pages had gotten muddy, including one with a rather nice picture of Valerian the Black Dread, done in coloured inks. Sam cursed himself for a clumsy oaf as he smoothed the pages down and brushed them off. Jilly's presence always flustered him and gave rise to, risings. A sworn brother of the Night's Watch should not be feeling the sort of things that Jilly made him feel, especially when she would talk about her breasts and,
"Lord Snow is waiting."
Two guards in black cloaks and iron half-helms stood by the doors of the armory, leaning on their spears. Hairy Hal was the one who'd spoken. Molly helped Sam back to his feet. He blurted out thanks and hurried past them, clutching desperately at the stack of books as he made his way past the forge with its anvil and bellows. A shirt of ringmail rested on his workbench, half-completed. Ghost was stretched out beneath the anvil, gnawing on the bone of an ox to get at the marrow. The big white direwolf looked up when Sam went by, but made no sound. John Solar was back beyond the racks of spears and shields. He was reading a parchment when Sam entered. Lord Commander Mormont's raven was on his shoulder, peering down as if he were reading too. But when the bird spied Sam, it spread its wings and flapped towards him, crying, "Corn! Corn!" Shifting the books, Sam thrust his arm into the sack beside the door and came out with a handful of kernels. The raven landed on his wrist and took one from his palm, pecking so hard that Sam yelped and snatched his hand back. The raven took to the air again, and yellow and red kernels went everywhere. "Close the door, Sam." Faint scars still marked John's cheek, where an eagle had once tried to rip his eye out. "Did that wretch break the skin?" Sam eased the books down and peeled off his glove.
"He did."
He felt faint.
"I'm bleeding."
"We all shed our blood for the watch. Wear thicker gloves." John shoved a chair toward him with a foot.
Sit and have a look at this."
He handed him the parchment.
"What is it?"
asked Sam. The raven began to hunt out corn kernels amongst the rushes. "A paper shield." Sam sucked at the blood on his palm as he read. He knew Maester Aemon's hand on sight. His writing was small and precise, but the old man could not see where the ink had blotted, and sometimes he left unsightly smears.
"A letter to King Tommen."
At Winterfell, Tommen fought my brother Bran with wooden swords. He wore so much padding he looked like a stuffed goose. Bran knocked him to the ground. John went to the window. Yet Bran's dead, and pudgy, pink-faced Tommen is sitting on the iron throne, with a crown nestled amongst his golden curls.
"Bran's not dead," Sam wanted to say. "He's gone beyond the wall with cold hands."
The words caught in his throat.
"I swore I would not tell." "You haven't signed the letter."
The old bear begged the Iron Throne for help 100 times. They sent him Janus Slint. No letter will make the Lannisters love us better. Not once they hear that we've been helping Stannis.
"Only to defend the wall, not in his rebellion."
Sam read the letter quickly once again.
"That's what it says here."
The distinction may escape Lord Tywin. John took the letter back.
"Why would he help us now?
He never did before."
"Well," said Sam, "he would not want it said that Stannis rode to the defence of the realm whilst King Tommen was playing with his toys. That would bring scorn down upon House Lannister."
"It's death and destruction I want to bring down upon House Lannister, not scorn." John lifted up the letter. "The Night's Watch takes no part in the wars of the Seven Kingdoms," he read. "Our oaths are sworn to the realm, and the realm now stands in dire peril. Stannis Baratheon aids us against our foes from beyond the wall, though we are not his men."
"Well," said Sam squirmy, "we're not, are we?"
"I gave Stannis food, shelter, and the night fort, plus leave to settle some free folk in the gift. That's all."
"Lord Tywin will say it was too much."
"Stannis says it's not enough. The more you give a king, the more he wants. We're walking on a bridge of ice with an abyss on either side. Pleasing one king is difficult enough. Pleasing two is hardly possible."
"Yes, but if the Lannisters should prevail, and Lord Tywin decides that we betrayed the king by aiding Stannis, it could mean the end of the Night's Watch. He has the Tyrells behind him, with all the strength of Highgarden, and he did defeat Lord Stannis on the Blackwater."
The sight of blood might make Sam faint, but he knew how wars were won. His own father had seen to that. The Blackwater was one battle. Rob won all his battles and still lost his head. If Stannis can raise the North...
"He's trying to convince himself," Sam realized. "But he can't."
The ravens had gone forth from Castle Black in a storm of black wings, summoning the lords of the North to declare for Stannis Baratheon and join their strength to his. Sam had sent out most of them himself. Thus far only one bird had returned, the one they'd sent to Carhold. Elsewise the silence had been thunderous. Even if he should somehow win the Northmen to his side, Sam did not see how Stannis could hope to match the combined powers of Castle Rock, Highgarden, and the Twins. Yet without the North, his cause was surely doomed.
"As doomed as the Night Watch, if Lord Tywin marks us down as traitors. The Lannisters had Northmen of their own, Lord Bolton and his bastard."
"Stannis has the Karstarks. If he can win White Harbour,
if," Sam stressed, "if not, my lord, even a paper shield is better than none."
John rattled the letter.
"I suppose so."
He sighed and took up a quill and scrawled a signature across the bottom of the letter. "Get the sealing wax." Sam heated a stick of black wax over a candle and dribbled some onto the parchment, then watched as John pressed the Lord Commander's seal down firmly on the puddle. "Take this to Maester Aemon when you leave," he commanded, "and tell him to dispatch a bird to King's Landing."
"I will." Sam hesitated. "My lord, if I might ask, I saw Gilly leaving. She was almost crying.
Val sent her to plead for Mansigan.
Oh!
Val was a sister of the woman the king beyond the wall had taken for his queen. The Wilding Princess was what Stannis and his men were calling her. Her sister Darla had died during the battle, though no blade had ever touched her. She had perished giving birth to Mance Raider's son. Raider himself would soon follow her to the grave. If the whispers Sam had heard had any truth to them.
What did you tell her?
That I would speak to Stannis, though I doubt my words will sway him. A king's first duty is to defend the realm, and Mance attacked it. His Grace is not like to forget that. My father used to say that Stannis Baratheon was a just man. No one has ever said he was forgiving. John paused, frowning. I would sooner take off Mance's head myself. He was a man of the Night's Watch once. By rights, his life belongs to us.
Pep says that Lady Melisandre means to give him to the flames, to work some sorcery.
Pip should learn to hold his tongue. I've heard the same from others. King's blood to wake a dragon? Where Melisandre thinks to find a sleeping dragon, no one is quite sure. It's nonsense. Mance's blood is no more royal than mine own. He has never worn a crown nor sat a throne. He's a brigand. Nothing more. There's no power in brigand's blood. The raven looked up from the floor.
Blood!
It screamed. John paid no mind. I'm sending Jilly away.
Oh! Sam bobbed his head. Well, that's good, my lord.
It would be the best thing for her, to go somewhere warm and safe, well away from the wall and the fighting. Her and the boy. We will need to find another wet nurse for his milk brother.
Goat's milk might serve, until you do. It's better for a babe than cow's milk.
Sam had read that somewhere. He shifted in his seat.
My lord, when I were looking through the annals, I came on another boy commander, 400 years before the conquest. Osric Stark was 10 when he was chosen, but he served for 60 years. That's 4, my lord. You're not even close to being the youngest ever chosen. You're 5th youngest so far.
The younger 4, all being sons, brothers, or bastards of the king in the north. Tell me something useful. Tell me of our enemy.
The others, Sam licked his lips. They are mentioned in the annals, though not as often as I would have thought. The annals I've found and looked at, that is. There's more I haven't found, I know. Some of the older books are falling to pieces. The pages crumble when I try and turn them. And the really old books, either they have crumbled all away, or they are buried somewhere that I haven't looked yet. Or, well, it could be that there are no such books, and never were. The oldest histories we have were written after the Andals came to Westeros. The first men only left us runes on rocks. So everything we think we know about the Age of Heroes, and the Dawn Age, and the Long Night, comes from accounts set down by septons, thousands of years later. There are archmaesters at the Citadel who question all of it. Those old histories are full of kings who reigned for hundreds of years, and knights riding around 1,000 years before there were knights. You know the tales, Brandon the Builder, Simeon Star Eyes, Knight's King. We say that you're the 998th Lord Commander of the Night's Watch, but the oldest list I've found shows 674 commanders, which suggests that it was written during...
Long ago, John broke in. What about the others?
I found mention of dragonglass, the children of the forest, used to give the Night's Watch 100 obsidian daggers every year during the Age of Heroes. The others call